Woodworking for the Blind presents Leslie Dixon, industrial design graduate and manual skills teacher at the Veterans Administration. Through woodworking, leatherworking, ceramics, and other crafts, Leslie is helping build the confidence in veterans as they expand their horizons of the possibilities that they can achieve. And you can find Woodworkers for the Blind on the web at www4b.org. A lot of blind and visually impaired woodworkers sharing ideas, thoughts, projects, and a lot of how-to-dos. And now our host, Daryl Vickers, will take it away.
This is my natural state of mind. Hey, everybody, it's like 7 o'clock, and I think we'll get started. Our guest today is Leslie Dixon. And before I jump too far, I just want to make a quick announcement. You know, the small box challenge that we did, like I said, we donated them to my senior center, and I don't have the exact total yet, but it's going to be a raffle, which happens Thursday. Debbie, the director, said the way it was looking right now that they're like setting records for tickets. So,
whoa,
I'm pretty happy about that. So
nice.
Hopefully we could raise some money for that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, for some food pantries and so forth in our area.
They really feel sorry for you, Daryl.
They do, yeah. Can you blame them?
Hello, everybody. This is Albert from the west coast of Canada.
Hi, Albert. How are you?
Hi, Albert.
You like making an entry, don't you, Albert?
Yeah. Sorry about that, Jeff.
Oh, no, it's fine. We're just getting rolling here.
Hey, Mr. Jeff, you got the recording started yet?
I'm way ahead of you. I made sure I got my jokes in first, so I always start before I start that bit. Hey, Daryl.
Yes.
Could we just go around and see who's here?
Yes, I'll go.
Well, we can certainly do that. Who wants to start?
How about Albert?
You want Albert? Go for it, Albert.
Oh, okay, Albert from the west coast of Canada.
Leslie from the coast of Mississippi.
Jeff Thompson from Friendly Fridley, Minnesota.
Andrew Apostolic from Arizona.
Dennis Walker from Idaho.
Scott Wheat from Montana.
And our fearless host,
Daryl Vickers from Missouri. And I don't know about that fearless part, buddy. So, Miss Leslie, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Hope everybody's getting ready for the holidays.
Trying to.
I actually have my shopping done early for a change. That's a new thing for me. I never tried that before.
Really? I'm going to sit by my mailbox, Daryl.
I try to have mine done before Thanksgiving, and that didn't happen this year, so I was panicking last week.
Whoa.
I've tried many times, but that's never happened.
Yeah, I always shop for Christmas Eve myself, but it does feel better getting it done early.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot simpler for me now than what it used to be, too. So,
because they can't remember?
Because they're little.
Yeah.
Amazon is our friend.
That's right. So, Miss Leslie, tell us a little about yourself, would you please?
So, I was born visually impaired, but had enough vision to get around without a cane most of the time. I was able to ride bicycles and read regular print, but not see well enough to drive a car. And as I got older, lost vision through various events, cataracts and retina detachments, to the point where I am now completely blind and have been for about 10 years. I grew up with my parents and one brother, a much younger brother, and was always the one that when my dad was fixing things around the house, I was the one sitting there going, "What are you doing? Show me how to do it. Show me how to piece of wood with a hacksaw. Show me how to do this." And just always loved learning how to fix things and how to work with my hands. That kind of led to, as I got older, fixing my own stuff around the house because I didn't like to wait on other people to do it. Just learning how to do things myself around DIY projects. That eventually led to me going to school to get a degree in industrial design and then getting a master's degree and teaching woodworking and leatherwork and other crafts at the VA, which is what I do now. And I've been doing that for about 6.5 years.
Very good. Then you grew up in Alabama?
I did. Yes. I grew up on the coast in Mobile and lived there for almost 30 years and then moved to Birmingham, Alabama for about 18 or so years before I moved to Mississippi.
Well, you're doing really good because I can actually understand you. Just kidding. Don't everybody get mad at me.
My first college degree was radio and television production. So I worked hard to lose my accent during that.
That must have been interesting type of work.
Mm-hmm. Lots of fun. Back when we were still editing tape with a reel to reel and a knife, I had a teacher that modified a soundboard for me, took the covers off the level indicators so that I could reach in and feel where my levels were as the needles were moving.
You know, that's actually really cool that people help somebody out that way, you know?
Yeah, I've been really lucky in that regard. When I went back to school in my 30s, I was the first visually impaired student in the industrial design program at Auburn. And having a building full of professors who were all professional product designers was a lot of fun, because if I needed to be able to do something like cut a piece of quarter inch foam board in half, just cut halfway through it, and was unable to do that by feel and keep a straight line, they helped me design a depth gauge for my X-Acto blade. And we sat down and we played with it and figured out the angles and how I was holding it and what exactly it needed to do. And by that afternoon, they took it down to the shop and turned an acrylic depth gauge for me on the lathe. And I had a tool by the end of the day. And we did that a lot for the 4 years I was in college. My teachers were always looking for solutions to problems I was running into.
Yeah, that's really cool. I don't really know. What is industrial design encompass?
Industrial design is the part of designing a product where it's the user experience part. So typically the parts of a device, just say, for instance, the iPhone, that are functional are likely designed by electrical engineers and software engineers. But the parts of the phone that you hold in your hand, the part that you touch, is likely designed by a product designer who thinks about how it's going to feel in your hand and how that's going to feel in the majority of people's hands, or as many people as possible, because you don't want something that feels good in a few people's hands, but is way too big or way too small for others. And you will have that to an extent, but you design for as many body types and people as possible. And you think about color and aesthetics and just the human interaction with that product. And industrial designers often work closely with engineers and marketing people to come up with the product. And we do a lot of research on what people are interested in, how people are going to use it, to ultimately get that product out there.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I heard that term before, but I've really understood what it truly meant.
So we did a lot of model building when I was in school. I built a full-size gas grill out of cardboard and wood, and it had to be, short of turning it on and cooking food, it had to be functional. So the lid had to open, the grill plates had to come out, any drawers or sliders had to be functional and sliding back and forth and moving in and out. And doing things like that was really challenging, and I became really good at cutting with an X-Acto blade and measuring with a click ruler, because that was my primary tool during that time. And at the time I was in college, I still had some vision. I didn't know anything about using power tools. I mean, I could use a hand drill and a cordless drill, or I could use a hacksaw, something like that. But I never used a bandsaw or a table saw. And so the school decided that for liability, they did not want me to operate any of the machines, because they didn't know how to teach me how to do it correctly and safely.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a good product manager. I would make all my marks on my boards, anything that I needed cut. I would do all the measurements, do drawings, take it down to the shop, and then I would have to manage the guys in the shop doing the actual cutting for me. And, you know, here's what you need to use to cut this, and here's how you need to cut it. And so I had to know all the mechanics of it and do everything short of making the actual cuts.
Well, that's very interesting. That would be kind of challenging, especially the types of things you were designing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still trying to picture this grill.
The frame was wood, so it basically just a tall rectangular wooden frame, and then it was covered on the outside with cardboard, and it had caster wheels underneath. I used drawer slides to make my drawers, and I would mount the cardboard on for the bottom of the drawer on a piece of plywood so that it had something to connect to the slides with. And and then I had screws or bolts on the lid for the hinges. I think I had a piano hinge on the lid for the side burner. And I had to cut the grill plates. We used a laser cutter for that. So I had to design my grill plates and lay it out and then take it down to the person that ran the laser cutter and have him cut it out of foam board, black foam board. And that way we could take the grates out and they would just sit down inside the grill and I could take the grates out and open and close the lid. But everything else was cardboard.
But you got exposed to a lot of different machines and so forth, even if you weren't using them for them to, for having all that done, right?
I did. We had a radial arm saw, table saw, bandsaw, drill press. We had a scroll saw, a couple of lathes, joiners, planers, and various sanders, belt sanders and drum sanders.
So migrating forward, so now you're, how long have you been with the VA?
I have been at the VA for 6.5 years here in Biloxi. And I started out teaching living skills, teaching cooking and home management. And that was essentially to get my foot in the door. My goal from the start of coming to the VA was to move into the manual skills department and teach what I teach now. And so I was in living skills for a year, and then I moved down to manual skills and started learning about leather work and ceramics. I was already doing metal embossing. So if any of y'all are veterans and have been to a VA blind rehab, Dennis, I think you might have, they make copper pictures where they lay the copper foil on top of a mold and rub the copper until the image comes up, the raised picture comes up into the copper. And that was something I was already doing as a hobby. I was actually designing my own templates and laying the copper face down on a soft mat and drawing from the back through the template and making my own design. So I didn't know that there were ready-made molds out there that I could be using. But I started in that and quickly became the most knowledgeable person in that department around woodworking. I had gone through the program at the Louisiana Center for the Blind, and that was where I first learned to use all the power tools. And my instructor just said, we're just going to show you how to do it safely. And he's like, there's nothing in here you can't use. You just have to learn how to do it right. And so I learned just about every machine in that shop and built a lot of projects in there. And toward the end of that program, because they knew I was planning to go into teaching in that area, he spent the last 3 months I was there showing me how to work with other students, showing me how to work hand over hand with people, showing me how to watch to make sure that people were doing things safely while keeping both of us safe. And also taught me about listening to the machines and being able to hear when something wasn't running right.
Was that JD?
It was JD, yes. JD and Mr. Mays.
Those people that we know from Louisiana VA?
This was the Louisiana Center for the Blind.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was before you went to work for the VA or afterwards?
It was before. I lost the rest of my vision in 2015. And I was in the middle of grad school at that point. And my vocational rehab counselor said, well, you've got to take some time off. Do you want to go to the Louisiana Center and get some training? Because I didn't know Braille. I didn't know much about using a screen reader at that time. I was still using magnification when I lost my vision. I knew a little bit about walking with a white cane, but I didn't know a lot. And I don't like to sit at home. So I needed to get out and learn everything I needed to know to be a blind person. And I went there for 7 months, learned computer skills, learned Braille, learned cane skills, and came out of that and went back to grad school to finish my degree so that I could get a job at the VA.
Oh, very good.
Thank you. It was a lot of work, but it was a great experience.
Well, most things, I guess things are worthwhile or a lot of work usually.
Yes. I was determined that I was not going to let losing my vision slow me down any more than it ever had to, because I love to travel. I love to get out and do things. I don't like to wait on other people to take me here, or take me there, or help me. So I needed to learn all the skills I needed to know to get out there and do it.
I personally went to the VA for the first time in like 2011. It's the first time I had any kind of formal training on anything. You know, I was self-taught with the canes. I still have a lot of bad habits and with all that, but I was there for like 4 weeks, and how well I could do though with the cane is really, I went there mostly for mobility because.
Right. I remember correctly that you went to Heinz.
Yeah, I went up to Heinz as our closest one. And I was in computers all my life. So those kind of skills I already had. So they had a little trouble finding things for me to do because I really went there, you know, for mobility. You can't do mobility 8 hours a day.
8 hours a day, right.
So I did a lot of that, some of that copper embossing and leather craft and all that stuff. So I've been there three times now. So
okay. Cool. They've got a nice shop from what I hear. I've not been up there, but I've heard they got a good setup.
Well, it's the only VA facility I've been in, but it's a very nice facility and it's laid out really well. And you could do just about anything there, I guess, as any other one, But like I said, it's the only one I'm familiar with, but the people up there were just so great. And I still have friends that work there.
Nice. They are very knowledgeable in our VA. Whenever we need something fixed in the shop, we are required to call the maintenance department and have them come over and do it. And the Heinz VA staff chose to learn how to fix all the machinery themselves so that they could teach that to the veterans who wanted to learn it. And I thought that was pretty great.
That's an interesting thing. When I went there in 2011, you go through and you have to do all the week-long assessments
Oh,
and
yes.
put the square pegs in the round holes and all that, and in 2011 I had zipped right through all that stuff, and in 2000, either 2020 or 19, I went up for a refresher mobility course and they made me take a little of that stuff again, and I had a heck of a time with all that. It's amazing what getting old does to one,
Yes, I was just making a leather bracelet today with a mystery braid in the middle, which means it's braided in the middle, but the ends are still closed. And just making that little bracelet hurt my hands so bad, I had to take a break.
I should ask ladies how old they are, but how old are you, Leslie?
I will be 52 in February.
Well, you sound so much younger, but the 52
Oh,
is
well,
not all
thank
that,
you.
not too old anyway, so.
It is some days. I had gotten COVID a couple years ago, and one of the long-term effects I had from COVID was that it damaged some of the nerves in my hands. And so I found it more challenging in the last few years to manipulate very small objects with my hands. I'd actually just gone through a class to learn how to do Perkins Braille repair and was unable to continue doing that because of my hands, because all those parts in there are so tiny. So I've been lucky to be able to continue doing what I'm doing now, but it definitely takes its toll when I'm working with small nails or screws or doing something complex like this mystery braid.
Yeah, and it's just amazing what all COVID can do to a person and to different people. So many people I know have been affected a lot of different ways,
Yeah, me too.
It's just kind of weird.
Yeah.
So before I open this up, and I am going to open it up for questions, but just going back to these glasses for a second. So when I talked to my viz coordinator about a month ago and asked him, if there's something I could get through the VA, she said no, because all I had was AI. It didn't OCR read things. Ever since I've got these, Leslie, it does better than most of my OCR things do for reading.
It does a good job, but what you'll find is that what you get a lot of times, unless it's less than maybe a paragraph, is that you get a summary of what you're reading. You don't always get word for word information, which is what OCR does. But yes, it does do a very good job of picking up the text and reading, and I've used mine quite a bit. Like I said earlier, I use mine at work every day to read labels on the shelf, and we have all of our cabinets set up so that our shelves are labeled with the different colors of stain that we use or different types of leather dye that we use. And we just have to pull from what's right above the label. And I can open the cabinet and point to a label and ask my glasses, to read the label that I'm pointing at. And it does a great job, better than any other device I have for that.
I guess that's true, because I really haven't asked it to read a whole page yet.
Right.
But the other day I asked it what I was holding in my hand. It was, if you own a home nowadays, you got these people that want to buy your house cheap, and what. I mean, anyway, it was just a card. The great thing about it was it was either handwritten or was written with a script font, but it read the whole thing, even though it was written out longhand. And
If you go to like a restaurant, you'll find and ask it to read the menu, you'll find it say things like, "This appears to be a menu from this restaurant," and it has things like this, burgers and sandwiches and salads and soups. And then you have to kind of dig down and say, okay, tell me what the salads are. And you have to really kind of ask it a lot of questions, but it's not going to just verbatim read the menu to you. And often it's pulling from a database of information that can sometimes be wrong. You just have to be kind of careful with it, but they do a great job for what they do. And they're about to come out with some really interesting new features.
well, it's just it was that, because it was the price,
Oh, yeah. The price makes a huge difference.
I could have a pair of Orcams. I couldn't stand the things that, they work even less than these glasses, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm.
Or Envision glasses, which are another, what, $3,000?
$3,000, yeah.
And they're not any better than these, mm-hmm. you know? So that's just the thing. It was just like, I don't know. But
the one thing these will never do, will likely never do, that some of the blindness related products like the Orcam or the Envision glasses do, is these will likely never identify people. Like, I couldn't even get it to tell. I was demonstrating this to one of my veterans today. I couldn't even get it to tell me what color his hair was. It just said, I'm not giving you any information about, any identifying information about this person. Now, it would tell me what color his shirt was, what his hat looked like, but it wouldn't tell me anything about him specifically. And I know that's something a lot of people like about Orcam and Envision, is being able to identify people. It's not something I've ever particularly been interested in, but
yeah, me either.
It is a big factor, and the OCR is also a big factor. But for the price point, you really can't beat them. I mean, $300 compared to $3,000 or more.
Well, yeah, and I wear sunglasses pretty much all the time, because the only thing I have left is light perception, but my eyes are so sensitive to it, I really can't hardly stand any light anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to buy a good pair of sunglasses, like I have Oakleys, and, you know, Ray-Bans are going to cost you $150 anyway.
At least, yeah. Sometimes some of the Ray-Bans were already $300
yeah.
without the AI.
So, yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry I digress, folks.
That's okay.
Anyone has some questions or wants to know some more about Leslie, chime in.
This is Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a workshop at home? And if so, what kind of tools and stuff do you have? A woodworking shop specifically.
Gotcha. So I live in an apartment.
Okay.
And as much as I would love to be able to turn my spare bedroom into a wood shop, the complex and the neighbors would kill me. So I've reframed. So I have a nice toolbox here. I have a Ryobi cordless portable drill. I have a variety of click rulers here, some standard and metric, just a lot of hand tools, hacksaw. So most of the work that I do, woodworking, if I need to do any woodworking, I can usually find a few minutes to at least rough cut some stuff at work that I can finish at home. But I unfortunately do not have any kind of a shop here at home.
You've got this all wrong. When the neighbor comes and says, your table saw is too noisy, you can tell them, table saw? I'm blind.
What table saw?
I wouldn't be using a table saw. That's dangerous.
Yeah, maybe so. Although some of my neighbors know better. So.
I know.
I have a nice little shed out on the patio, and I've got a decent sized patio. So I've considered maybe buying a few things that I could bring out on the patio and use. But I'd also like to explore a little more into the hand tool realm and see what I can do with hand tools.
I would think your experience in the past would lend you very well to hand tools, probably.
Mm-hmm. It does. So I cut some things up here at home with the hacksaw, and I've got some saw horses and lots of clamps, and I can do a little bit of stuff here.
I've thought for quite a while that I'd like to get better with hand tools,
mm-hmm.
but I'm inherently lazy.
Well, that's part of my problem, too.
And you see, a table saw works so much faster.
Oh, it does. Those are beautiful. It's one of my favorite tools. Table saws and routers.
Leslie?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about training new students, and then when they come back, working with more experienced students?
Mm-hmm. So sadly, as Daryl mentioned a few minutes ago, you know, about going to the VA for about 4 weeks at a time, it's not a lot of time to train somebody new who doesn't have experience in the wood shop. And so what I usually start with is measuring and marking in the classroom, and that, you know, even if that pertains to leather or other projects, they can learn measuring. They can learn using tape to mark things off, or using an awl to mark things, using a click ruler and a talking tape measure. And that may be their only introduction. If they're comfortable, we will go over and cut some stuff in the wood shop. One of our projects that we make, and we typically pre-make a lot of kits. So we have some birdhouse kits and bird feeders and other small projects that veterans who are not comfortable in the wood shop can do in the classroom. They can sand it and they can glue it together and paint it or stain it. If they're feeling a little more comfortable with going in the wood shop, one of the things that we can do is when they put an amplifier box together, for instance, it's stacking four pieces of wood together. And sometimes those don't always clamp up square. They might slip a little bit with the glue. And we can go over and I will teach them how to use the table saw to square their box up, just trimming a little bit off the edge. And we'll work hand over hand. I might do the first cut for them to talk them through the process. And then I'll go hand over hand with them as they finish trimming their own box. And so that may be their introduction. Maybe they want to drill. We had a veteran who wanted to assemble his box with pegs instead. So we went and learned how to use the drill press to drill some holes for wooden dowels so that he could put dowels through the four pieces of the box and assemble it that way. So that may be all the introduction they get initially. But then when they come back, if they're interested in going back into the shop, then we may move to making something like a picture frame. And they can certainly, in their first time at the center, if they're feeling comfortable, you know, we may have them make the picture frame with a hacksaw and a miter box. Or if their disability does not allow them to stand in front of a miter saw or a table saw, we'll help them cut up some of the, you know, get some of the pieces set up for them and then have them measure and mark and cut their angles to make their frame with the miter box and then glue it together. And then we have our experienced woodworkers who come in and they do a lot of teaching me how to do things. So they come in and say, I've been a woodworker for 30 years and I want to build a jewelry box. I had a gentleman came in and wanted to build a shadow box. And I said, I've never built a shadow box before, but we'll figure it out. And he knew what to do. And so at that point, it's a matter of you teach me the process of building this box and I'll teach you how to do it safely. And I'll teach you how to do your measurements and your marks. And we'll go through that process that way. And then I have guys who have been repeat offenders so many times that they just come in and you can almost turn them loose in the shop and what they want to do.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Do you ever get females coming through the shop?
We do. We have a woman there now who is actually an experienced woodworker. And so she saw some of the pre-made picture frames that we did for the copper pictures and decided that she wanted to do something different. And so she has gone in and built her own frames for that. She is making a little jewelry box, but her idea came from a piece that we had on our display table that was to hang on the wall. It had little doors and you opened it up and it had hooks for all your keys. And she wanted to modify that to make it into a jewelry box. And so she's gone over in the shop and we've worked with her on mostly on safety. She knows how to make the cuts. And, you know, that's one of the things that I like to remind the veterans who come in who are experienced is that you didn't forget your skills. All your knowledge of woodworking or home repair is still there. We just have to change the way you think about how to do it. And we talk about organization and labeling and laying things out and taking your time and getting your projects organized and ready to go so that when you're ready to grab a tool, it's laying right there where you left it and all your screws and parts are sorted out, whether it's in a muffin tin for baking or it's in an ice cube tray or laid out in bowls, however you want to organize your stuff. We also use tackle boxes for fishing with those little removable compartments so that you can change the size of the compartments for those and lay your stuff in there. And then you've also got a box that has a lid. So at the end of the day, when you're done with your project, you can close the lid and not have to worry about everything spilling if you knock it over.
Takes a lot of confidence.
It does. And I have excellent organizational intentions, and then it all goes chaotic after that.
But I mean, to teach someone, how do you gain their confidence that you can teach them?
Yeah, with some people, it's a lot of patience. I had a gentleman who actually got more nervous the more cuts we made, which was the first time I've ever seen that. He started out, he felt pretty comfortable that he could do it, and he made a cut, and he said he was comfortable making the second cut. But by the fourth cut, he's like, I can't do this anymore. And he was done. Some of them, all they need to make is that first cut. All they need to know is that it's still possible. Even if they have no interest in woodworking as a hobby, they know that it's possible to do it. And that's one step closer to doing anything they want. And knowing that, you know, when somebody tells them you can't do this, there's probably a way.
It's very empowering using that table saw, you know.
Yes, it is.
The thing still scares me to death, but I still use it, you know.
I told my mobility instructor at Louisiana Center that the wood shop is my happy place. I go in there, my blood pressure goes down. I am perfectly calm and happy. And he said, how can you say that when you're using things like table saws and radial arm saws or drill presses? And I said, because I'm the one in control of those. I have to set it up. I have to make sure all my safety checks are in place. And then I'm the one that turns the switch on and runs the machine and turns the switch off when I'm done. And when I go out on the street, I have no control over what those cars are doing.
Hallelujah.
So I'm much more happy in the wood shop. And that table saw is not chasing me down the roads. It's sitting
May
still.
have
I
missed
have to
it.
go to it.
I may have missed it if you said it. Do you use saw stop saws?
We do. And I think that is mostly due to the fact that we have to, by law, use saw stop saws. I honestly try to not even tell veterans that's what it is. Some of them figure it out pretty quickly, or some of them ask, and I won't tell them it's not. But I do try to emphasize that even though this does have a brake and it does have safety measures, that you should always still practice safety techniques. Almost every person I've seen come through my shop with missing fingers has said, I was in a hurry. I was thinking about other things. I was distracted. That's when you get hurt. I mean, accidents do happen, but a lot of times it's because we're not focused on what we're doing. And so always checking to make sure everything's in place and that your hands are where they're supposed to be, regardless of whether the saw will stop when you touch it or not.
Leslie,
Yes, sir.
what type woodworking tools, hand tools, or power tools, other than a click rule and a talking tape measure, will the VA issue?
It's different for every VA. There's a saying that says if you've been to one VA, you've been to one VA. They're all a little bit different. So I know Hines and I think Waco will both issue saw stops.
Okay.
I wish I'd have known that before I bought it.
Well, I was one of the first ones to get a saw stop out of Birmingham until I forget what his name is, the chief of prosthetics, found out about
They're sticklers in Birmingham. They don't issue much.
it. Well, they were issuing saw stops at that time.
I think Birmingham was also issuing CNC routers at one point. I don't know if they still do.
Okay.
We have been told that we are able to issue a saw stop at our VA, but we've never had a veteran that interested in woodworking to issue it, so I've never done it. It is supposedly possible.
Okay.
Leslie, it's Albert. What is a stop saw stop?
A saw stop?
Yeah.
So that is a table saw where there's a special brake that's connected to the saw in a sensor so that if anything organic, your finger in demonstrations, they often use a hot dog, anything organic touches that blade, it immediately stops the brake. It slams this brake into the blade, often breaking it or bending it pretty severely. And it stops the machine so that the most damage you get is a scratch. It prevents you from being able to accidentally cut your fingers off. And I've heard that there's talk that it's going to be a requirement that all table saw manufacturers add this to their saws. But I don't know if that's going to be a reality or not. I just heard it's something there that's being considered, some law that's being considered for that. I have tripped it twice. Once the blade had almost, I mean, it was probably a half inch turn from stopping. So it was moving so slow, it couldn't have possibly hurt me. And I didn't even touch the cutting edge of the blade. I touched the side of the blade. I was checking the side of the blade to see if there was any debris over there before we made the next cut. And as soon as my finger touched that blade, it tripped the brake. And it shuts the machine off. You can't use it again until you change out the brake mechanism and the blade. And the other time that I did it, I did actually touch the cutting edge, but it was moving slow enough that instead of scratching me, it just bruised me as the tip of the point of the saw blade kind of popped my thumb and gave me a bruise more than anything.
Yeah, I think I need one of those brakes put on my router because I trimmed my fingernail on my ring finger a couple of weeks ago with the router.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, our router at work actually scares me because we have a router table and it's set up so high it's at eye level. If any of this shoots off in my face, I'm not going to be happy. So we've been trying to get it lowered down, but so far we're still staring that router bit right in the face.
When you tripped a brake on the saw stop, did you have to take the brake and the saw blade off?
No, because our VA requires that maintenance comes over and does all that. So even just to have a blade changed, we have to call our maintenance department, which is annoying because sometimes we have to wait 2 or 3 days. It means having a machine down for a couple of days until they get over there.
Well, I've tripped my brake once. It's difficult to get that brake and the saw blade off.
I bet it is. And it's expensive because you've got to replace that mechanism and you've got to replace the blade. So you're looking at about $100.
But at least you have five fingers on each hand to do it.
You do still have five fingers. Absolutely.
SawStop will send you a new brake for free.
Oh, will they? Okay. Did not know that.
Yeah.
Need to keep that in mind.
You have to fill out a report to them on a form and then send the brake back and they'll analyze it.
Mm-hmm.
And if their analysis shows that it was a flash contact, they'll send you a new brake for free.
Yeah. I have only experienced it once, but I have seen it happen a couple times where even a really wet piece of wood will trigger it. There's too much moisture in the wood that can trigger it that way as well.
I think I'll just keep focusing on being careful.
On being careful, yeah. I certainly don't count on it. I don't know. I've heard that the CEO of the SawStop company demonstrates this all the time by touching it with his finger, and he's a braver man than I. I just don't trust any piece of technology that much.
Book size, this is for you, Leslie, and Daryl.
Mm-hmm.
You each have a SawStop. Dennis, I believe you too. What size do you all have? I mean, there's a 1.5 horsepower, which can be 115 volt, but I don't know, cabinet size or what?
I actually don't know. I know it's a 10-inch blade, but I don't know anything else about it.
Mine's the industrial saw with a 3-horse motor. And the difference between the industrial and the professional is in front of the blade, there's about an extra 4 or 5 inches. The table's deeper.
It's more cabinet saw size. My professional, the same exact size as my rigid contractor saw was. Literally, it measured exactly the same as far as the top. If you're going to get a new saw, not only does it have this technology, but it is a very nice saw. I mean, SawStop, they did not spare any expense on designing or machining and manufacturing this saw. So it has some cool features to it. You know, you can make a bevel cut on a saw stop where you tilt the blade, but you don't have to put a different insert in there.
No, we don't either.
Because the whole blade arbor moves to the right as mm-hmm. it tilts to the left. So you use the same insert for straight cuts and 45 degree cuts. Just things like that. It just has some really nice features and it cuts really well. The industrial size is more the size of a real, what I call a real cabinet saw. This pro saw is more like a hybrid saw to me because it's even the motor's not, that's really in the cabinet. It's kind of off to the side of the cabinet, but not in behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them are cheap, but I don't care if you go out and whatever new table saw you're going to get, none of them are cheap. So
right.
Spend a few $100 more and get the brake mechanism. Trust me, I already tested it.
It works.
It works.
Yep.
In fact, they guarantee it now not to even break the skin. So, and it didn't.
When I hit it the second time, it did not break the skin. It bruised my finger pretty good, but it did not break the skin.
Wow.
I honestly didn't even know I did it because as soon as you do it, it instantly stops, but it also drops the blade down below the table.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden there was nothing there and I didn't even realize that I'd done it.
Well, Leslie, I've got the saw for your cupboard out on your patio because mine is a 10-inch construction table saw.
Mm-hmm.
That has the folding leg. So you fold it all up. It's got two wheels. You wheel it up against the wall and there it is.
Yeah, I've been considering that. I might have to make it happen one day.
Yeah, like this saw does not have the wings that you guys talk about. This saw has a fence, an L-shaped fence that goes way out beyond the end of the saw. And so you could still rip something at, I don't know, 30 some odd inches, and the wood is being held out there at that far end by the fence.
Nice.
So I've really enjoyed learning how to use this saw.
Yeah, that's great.
And because the rule in this house is the car will only stay in the driveway for maximum 2, maybe 3 nights. So I have to be able to fold things up and put it all away.
Gotcha. I'm not comfortable ripping long boards on my own. I will often chop up my boards on the miter saw before I rip them, if I have to rip them by myself.
If I rip anything long, let's say I've got a radial arm saw that's got on a 12-foot long bench. So I prefer to do long rips on the radial arm saw, but small stuff on the table. So.
Gotcha. I will get in. As a matter of fact, I did this today. My coworkers and I will just team up and one of us catch, even because we've got the stands, the rollers, but I'm still not comfortable ripping a board that long by myself. So mm-hmm. I'll either chop it up or get somebody to catch for me.
Well, I was excited to hear that one where the blade is back further on the table because I've been ripping longer boards. And when you only have, 10, 12 inches, whatever you have along your fence, it's hard to get your board started perfectly straight, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can have it back on a roller there, but as you start cutting, everything straightens out real quick.
Right.
But having it deeper, that gives you a chance for a longer fence and then more accurate starting of your cuts on longboards.
If you need help with that, I've seen a jig that you can make that you can attach to your fence and basically take a 5 foot long piece of 3/4 inch plywood. And then on mine, I have it grooved on the backside for the match fit clamps so I can clamp it to my fence.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the overhang in front of the saw, it'll hang. I think I have a 3 foot long fence, so it hangs like 2 feet in front of the saw. I put another piece of 3/4 inch plywood that I glued onto the bottom of it.
Oh, to hold it.
So that it's level with the top of the table saw.
Mm.
Wow.
And basically it provides like a 3 inch wide strip that you can use as an extension to your saw's tabletop.
Nice.
To help support long pieces on the infeed. Mm. Pretty inexpensive and easy to do, and you can take it on and off real easy.
Yeah, that solidifies the little thought bubble that I've had in my mind over the last few weeks. Yeah, thank you.
Yep.
That's one area where I'm really having to learn. I've gotten pretty good at kind of reverse engineering things. We had a volunteer who used to make a lot of stuff for us. And when he left, I had to look at all these projects and go, okay, how do we do this? And because I was the one with the most experience out of my coworkers, I was training them on how to do things. And so I would take this birdhouse or amplifier box or various projects and okay, we're going to need the scroll saw for this, or we're going to need the bandsaw for that, and cut this on the miter saw and this on the table saw, and kind of reverse engineer all that. But I'm really having to learn to be more efficient in my cutting and setting up stop blocks and working with jigs or templates, because sometimes I've got an hour to go in there and make as many projects as I can, kits as I can make before the next class. So that's been my biggest learning experience right now, is just efficiency.
I think making templates and jigs is a whole nother ballpark of wood. People just want to go in and cut and stuff like that. But once you get past that and you want to make more than one,
mm-hmm,
or 10 of something, then you start all over with the jig making and the efficiency, like you said. Yeah, that's cool.
So many jigs and fixtures.
Remember when we had the micro jig guys, they talked about that, that pusher, I don't even remember what he called it, but it's that sort of three-legged gizmo for pushing wood.
A gripper
to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I bought two of those. Oh my God, how come I didn't have that 10 years ago? Man, talk about a confidence booster when you're pushing wood through the table saw.
That's 100% true too, because I just got my first one a couple of years ago and I should have done it a lot sooner than that.
Yeah.
I love mine.
Matter of fact, I like it so much I bought two.
I had mine for a year and a half before I first used it. And it was after we did the interview with them. Yeah, same thing came to mind. You can get skinny pieces. You can bring them through there. I was like, wow, kicking myself in the butt.
Yeah. I have to hide mine at work. I bought one on my own money and I hide it when I'm not using it so nobody will steal it.
You're making me feel guilty. After we had the micro jig people on, I bought one of the gripper. Their most expensive one, you know, the whole big whatever it is. I forget mm-hmm. the model of it. But I also bought the gripper to go, the small one that just, you know, and I've used that one, but I've never put the other one together. I got to get out there and actually do that.
That was a fun puzzle.
Using the gripper to go, you want to be awful careful not to hit those legs with your saw, because it'll take that leg right off and they're not replaceable.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I am careful, but it has come in awful handy, because I did have to cut some narrow strips one day and I decided, you know, I'm going to use this bugger. And it really did work well, though.
I think putting the gripper together is really, I would say, clear off a big area and have some places to put some smaller parts, because there's some little techniques that they have, like the little ring washers to hold mm-hmm. this bolt in there. I think, Daryl, you were talking about that one time.
Yep.
It's really neat, but there's a lot of little parts. But if you take it step by step and keep a clean area organized, I would even suggest little boxes to put stuff in. But then once it's together, it's like, oh, I get it. It's really cool.
I'll have to do that, because I kind of opened the box and looked it over the other day, but I haven't put it together. So I need to get on that.
It's not nearly as intimidating as it looks.
No.
There's actually a video that pretty much explains it too. But honestly, once you get started on, and it's actually very simple. And I have the grippers to go. I've already done what Dennis said. I haven't cut the leg completely off, but I've narrowed it quite a bit. And but I still prefer to use the big one. So
I didn't know they had a bigger one. Okay.
I put the bigger one together, and I spent about, I laid it all out, and I probably spent about 20 minutes working out how everything went together. And I think I still had to take part of it apart and redo to put the part in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But once I worked it out, it went together pretty quickly.
Yeah, I don't blame you for hiding it.
There's a little bit of that, but it's,
yeah.
I don't know. Every time I open up one of these boxes with something in it, it has all these parts, I immediately go, I'll never do this. You know, I got to find somebody with eyes. And that's just my first reaction. But lo and behold, if I just slow down and separate all the pieces, most of the time it's not all that hard.
I am the self-proclaimed queen of flat pack furniture. I love assembling stuff.
Mm.
I helped my neighbor was having a baby earlier this summer, and we put together a dresser and the crib, and her husband was like, I got nothing. I'm like, I got this. Let's do it. So I went over there and put all kinds of things together for her. And I had a blast. I just lay it all out on the floor and I sit in the middle of it like a big kid with a bunch of toys.
Well, Leslie, I sure appreciate you doing this.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
Really glad you're in woodworking for the blind too, by the way.
Me too. I have learned a lot from you guys.
Well, you contribute a lot too, so thank you.
Always enjoy our calls. Thank you. Y'all have a great night.
Be sure to check out www4b.org, Woodworkers for the Blind. Become part of the community and learn from others. Hope you enjoyed, and until next time, bye-bye.